Good morning, it's 9:06. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. Before we start the program, here's an update on Kathleen's health. Kathleen was out with the flu last week and is still recovering. We all hope she'll be back soon.
Have you ever stopped to think about how your actions add up over a lifetime? Just think of all the things we produce and consume. Imagine the food we eat, all the soda we drink, all the water we flush down the drain, all the clothing we buy, the amount of fuel we use, and all the things we depend upon. We're going to lay out some of the everyday goods we consume in our lives to show the impact each of us makes upon the world. It's the journey of a lifetime, and as we take each step, we will see how we leave our impression, our stamp upon the world. This is our human footprint.
Well, how often do we think about what our consumption of food, water, and other resources means to the earth? Some of us think about it a lot. Others, probably only when someone reminds us. And to be honest, I'm probably in that category. What you just heard was the introduction to a new television program made for the National Geographic Channel that literally shows what our consumption means to the planet from the time we're born until the time we shuffle off this mortal coil. The program will be broadcast on the National Geographic Channel this Sunday evening at 8 o'clock Central Time. And this morning, we're going to talk about our human footprints with an ecologist. My guest this hour is Eric W. Sanderson, Associate Director of the Living Landscapes Program of the Wildlife Conservation Society. He's also part of the team that created the Human Footprint Map, the first look at human influence globally. As always, you're welcome to join in with your questions and comments. Here are your phone numbers, 800-486-8655, that's a toll-free number, 800-486-8655, toll-free. If you're calling from Milwaukee, we have a local number for you to use, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And we have an email address as well. Here it is, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. All right, with that preamble, good morning, Mr. Sanderson, and welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you, John? Hello?
Yes. Okay, I'm sorry. I had the wrong button pushed and couldn't hear you for just a moment there.
Okay. So, hi. Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good, except for that one little error there. We'll hope that's the last one, but we'll see.
No worries.
Anyway, your team took a look at the Earth and measured how much of it is directly impacted by humanity. What did you find?
That's right. We were interested in trying to create a map of how human beings, as a global population, influence the planet. So what we did is we took data on the distribution of people. These are all publicly available data that you can get from the Internet, a map of human population density, a map of human land use derived from satellites, a map of access from roads and rivers and railways and from the coastline, and a map of the lights you can see from a satellite at night. And we added those all together. And if you add them all up, it turns out that one or more of those different things, those factors influence 83% of the land surface and 98% of the places where it's possible to grow rice, wheat, or corn on the planet.
Well, give me an example of some of the places that would be in that 17% that didn't have the activity you were looking at.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question, because if you look at the map, the places that are greenest, the places that are the most wild on today's planet are actually the places where it's also hard for people to live. So the boreal forests of Russia and Canada, the deserts, the Sahara Desert in Africa, the Central Australian Desert, the deserts of Western China and Central Asia, and then the Amazonian forest in the neotropics in Latin America. That's where the 17% is. And the places that are most influenced are the places that we kind of all know the names of, New York City, Beijing, London, Paris, the big cities of the world. They're at the other extreme, the most influenced. But interestingly, most of the world is somewhere in between, right? It's in that gradient of human influence that is actually our suburbs, our farms, our fields, and and the sort of wild places that are just beyond those.
So what does this mean?
Well, I think it means several different things. One thing it means for sure is that there's no more world left, as it were, right? You know, a lot of America was settled with this idea of the continuing frontier, so we could use up this place where we are, because there would always be some place over the next hill or in the next valley that we could go and settle and use next. But that idea, I think, doesn't really apply in the 21st century world anymore. There's no new place we can go that's going to be good for us to live, which I think means we need to take on an ethic of taking care of the places where we are now and living in them in such a way that they'll continue to be good for us and good for all the other creatures that we live with, all the plants and animals and ecosystems forever, right, for the rest of time. You know, that's the goal. It also means that that there's this gradient that I was talking about. I think people tend to think of a place either as human-dominated or a place as really wild, right? Like there's just two, like black and white or a zero and a one. But in fact, you know, most of the world is somewhere in between, right? Even in the wildest places, the Sahara Desert or in the middle, the deepest part of the Amazon forest, there still are human influences, you know. Our maps don't capture climate change because we couldn't get the data at the right resolution. They don't capture air pollution, you know, for the same reason. But those things are influencing places even that are marked as wild and untouched on our maps. But the opposite is also true. If you go, you know, into a big city, I'm speaking to you from Manhattan today, you know, one of the most influenced places on the planet, but the sun still shines, the rain comes down, you know, 300-some-odd birds are seen in New York City every year. There's fish in the harbor. You can't exclude nature, right? So these ideas of a place that's totally wild and without people, well, that's kind of a fantasy. That place never really existed or hasn't really existed, you know, in historical time. But it's also true that a place that entirely excludes nature, that's only about people, that place doesn't exist either.
Let's refer specifically now to the television program, which was the genesis for this talk show.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers that were used in the television program about what we consume and what happens to it, the consumption numbers. How were those numbers arrived at?
Yeah, so these are the filmmakers who made the film. You know,
right.
our role is sort of advising on the film and, you know, what the sum total of all this influence means for the world. But what I understand they did is they used, you know, standard statistical sources, you know, the U.S. government. These are all the statistics are about Americans and what Americans consume, and there's a lot of economic statistics that they could draw from. And then they had a very thorough review process through the National Geographic Society channel to try and make sure that they had all their numbers right. And then what they did is they took these sort of consumption figures on a daily basis and then multiplied them out for an average American what it would be over their lifetime.
And that lifetime is estimated at 77 years and 9 months.
That's on the average. That's right.
And that's in the United States.
That's in the United States. That's right. So all these figures that we'll be talking about are just for the United States and an average person in the United States. Of course, any individual might be more or less. But it turns out, as you alluded to in your opening, that the numbers get quite big quite fast, even on an individual basis, if you calculate over your life. So,
Well, I've got some of those in front of me. I want to just mention them.
Please.
In my lifetime, I will have consumed, as if I'm an average person. Of course, I really would like to think of myself as above average in some ways, but let's leave that discussion for another hour. 39,146 cups of coffee. I will have eaten over 5,000 bananas. Boy, that would be a real indigestion trip. What are some of the other things here? I will have taken 28,433 showers, consumed over 13,000 pints of milk, eaten 4,376 loaves of bread, and we'll have consumed 12,129 hamburger buns. These are just some of the statistics that are tossed out, and that seems, you know, well, rather fanciful, but the numbers are there. I guess our mission this hour is to try to translate that into what is the impact on the planet of all that consumption. And so the question is, I will have consumed 40,000 cups of coffee, so what?
That's right. So, and I should just say, you know, in the film, the way they try and get these ideas across is you know, because we hear these statistics all the time, but sometimes, you know, a number just by itself doesn't really mean very much. So what they try to do is these kind of visual demonstrations. So without using any special effects, they laid out, for example, rubber duckies, one rubber ducky per shower that you would take. So it's 28,000 some odd rubber duckies. And they lay them out, you know, coming out of a bathroom and down the steps of a house and out the front door and back around the barn and through a field and finally into the little pond that's back behind the house. And, you know, they show you what 28,433 rubber duckies look like. And it's a lot of rubber duckies. They laid out all the pints of milk, you know, an average American drinks 13,056 pints of milk. And so they laid out those pints of milk, and they, you know, they fill a front yard and fill a street in front of it. And so, and then they filmed these things, you know, with some very, you know, I think kind of interesting shots and some sort of playful music behind, so that you get this sort of sense of what it is as it builds up through the film. The sort of motif of the film is following two young Americans, a boy and a girl, through their lifetimes, from the time they're born and they're in diapers till the time they're retiring and, you know, at the end of their lives, and all the things that a person would consume across that time.
Well, let's talk about those diapers for just a moment. And for whatever reason, the sheet of paper I had those stats on didn't make it into the studio, but it was quite striking to see what all goes into disposable diapers, and just about every parent has used them. And even if you don't, the amount of laundry you end up doing if you use reusable diapers, it also has its own impact. But disposable diapers, they had a shot showing all of the pints of crude oil that goes into manufacturing the diapers that the average baby would use, the number of trees that would be required for the fill in the diaper, and plastic and so forth, all the various components. It was quite a stunning shot. And then when you think about all that ending up in a landfill someplace, that gave me some pause.
Yeah, no, that's right. You know, sometimes we, you know, we think about it just as each individual product, but, you know, in a globalized economy, most of the products that we consume are actually, they have several components to them, right? Whether it's a diaper, or whether it's a car, whether it's an appliance of some sort, and each of those individual components has to be sourced from someplace in the world. And that, you know, that leads to this phenomena called over-the-horizon consumption, right? So that what we consume today, most of the environmental effects of what we consume are actually over the horizon. They're in places we can't see because they're actually global, right? If we were a Native American, right, living in Wisconsin, you know, 400 years ago, everything we would have needed would have come from right around where we lived, right? The food and the water and the shelter, and there would have been a little bit of trade, but it wouldn't have been a big part of the kind of material economy of those people. But that's totally changed in today's world. Most of the things that we consume don't come from our local environment. They come from someplace else, and they come through these economic chains that, not necessarily in an intentional way, but hide that information from us, right? So we eat so many bananas, but what does that mean for the tropical forests in Costa Rica or Nicaragua or Guatemala that were converted into banana plantations, right? And because it's so far away, it's a little bit hard to see, and that's why, you know, I think kind of the work that we do at the Wildlife Conservation Society is really important, and the maps, like the map of the human footprint, really tries to show what the global pattern of human influence is.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the rainforest angle on the bananas, because that reminded me, I think it was the April 7th edition of Time Magazine, had an interesting article that talked about how, because so much corn right now is being used to produce biofuels, ethanol, farmers in the United States have switched from soybeans to corn, and that is indirectly leading to an increase in the deforestation of the Amazon rainforest, because more pasture land is being converted to soybeans because the price is up, and to get more pasture land, ranchers are cutting down more and more of the rainforest and the savanna, and it's... So, you know, just if the price of something goes up in one place in the world, that can have a huge impact on the environment somewhere else. And this is unprecedented, really, in human history, is the amount of global effect that one person's activity, say, in Manhattan or Madison, Wisconsin, or wherever, can have on the rest of the world.
That's right. That's right. I mean, that's such the... It's both the remarkable thing and the great tragedy of the globalized economic system that we have is... The remarkable thing is actually that it works, right? That you can get up in the morning and if you just look at your breakfast table and think about where all that stuff was sourced from, where the coffee came from and where the water came from and where the toast and the cheese and the milk and whatever it is you eat for breakfast, where those things came from, and for most of us it's actually the whole world. And it's remarkable, right, that we can be living in here in the United States, and I can go to whatever, the donut shop, and get a bagel and a cup of coffee, and pay a little bit of money, but not a huge amount of money, and that it actually works, right? That it assembles all of those materials and brings them to me. But the great tragedy is that there's all these costs that are not visible to me when I'm making that decision about what I want to have for breakfast, right? And that has to do with the needs for the economic system to have standardized products and products on time, which means that the places they're sourcing from all have to work. They have to they have to be homogenized. The farms need to be made the same. They can't be little diverse farms. And it's easier for the big companies to work with other big companies, which creates these large agricultural farms and companies. All these demands of the economic system, of the global economic system that delivers a cup of coffee and a bagel, are having consequences out in the world that we have a really hard time understanding and measuring and relating to.
We need to take a break, and then when we come back, we'll see who wants to join us on the phone. We're talking about a television program which will air this coming Sunday at 8 o'clock Central Time. And the program is called Human Footprint. It's on the National Geographic Channel. It talks about how much each of us will use and what kind of waste we'll produce over our lifetime and what that has as an impact on the planet. If you'd like to join us, here's how you do it. Here's a phone number for you, 800-486-8655. That's toll-free, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, please use our local number, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And you can also send us an email. Here's the address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 26 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. According to Ben Maron's guest after 5 today, parents and educators should focus on children's strengths rather than their weaknesses. That's after 5 o'clock today here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about what we consume if we're an average American, our consumption, and the waste that it produces and other effects are featured in a new National Geographic special called Human Footprint, which will be broadcast this coming Sunday at 8 o'clock Central Time on the National Geographic Channel. My guest is Eric Sanderson, Associate Director of Living Landscapes of the Living Landscapes Program of the Wildlife Conservation Society. And he's joining me by phone, and you can too. Here are the numbers again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. In Milwaukee, it's a local call for you. Please use 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. You can also send us an email. Here's the address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Okay, we've got some people who want to join us by phone, and since that's why we're here, let's get to it. Dan and Madison, you're first up. Dan, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was just, I'm always really interested in any comments about the environment at large, and hearing that part of, I didn't catch the whole first part of the show, but it made me think about what Darwin had said, or a quote from him, and I might not say it exactly, that given the chance, any species will tend to outbreed its living area or its living space. And I know that's not exactly right, probably, but it just makes me think about, and also when I was driving to get to a certain destination this morning, I was kind of flabbergasted by all the pickup trucks that weren't out there this morning and stuff like that, and how everything just kind of in a fuzz because of everything going on, all the demand, you know, from like your guest is saying about things coming from different parts of the world, and how demand in one place affects like China demand, you know, for oil, affects how we get it, and it's bringing part of the economy down. And that, I don't really, that's about all. I was just kind of flitting back and forth between different things while I was listening.
Well, Dan, thanks for that call. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Yeah, so I think, John, that Dan brings up a really good point, which is that's right, that every creature, a plant, an animal, including animals that are people, right? People are animals too, that every individual, you know, has these basic requirements, and their food and their water and their shelter, and they're the resources we need to raise our kids. And, I'd argue also that human beings, perhaps special, you know, maybe not unique, but special in the world, also, you know, need a sense of meaning and purpose, right? And those are our kind of basic habitat requirements, if you like. And so the struggle that we have now at the beginning of the 21st century is how to meet those habitat requirements for 6.6 billion people going to, you know, estimates are 10 to 12 billion people by the end of the century, and not do it and do it in such a way that we don't wreck the planet, right? That we continue to have a planet that supports us and that sustains all the other things on the planet that we love and cherish and depend on, including animals and plants and so forth. That's the big challenge, and it's hard to wrap your mind around. I mean, I've been working on this in this field for more than 10 years now, and have a lot of training before, and it's a big thing to take on, and it's hard for a couple reasons. One is because there are 6.6 billion of us, and so, you know, how and what are each one of us going to do about that? And I think sometimes conservationists and environmentalists have put too much stress on our individual choices, right? Because it is hard to know what to do on an individual basis. We can all do positive things, and I encourage everyone listening to do the positive things they can to drive less and to change their light bulbs to more energy efficient forms and to use less water. But I don't encourage people to not continue living their lives. Right? Everybody needs to live their life and find meaning in their life. So at another level, you know, we also need help from the sort of larger organizations of people, from companies and from governments and from community groups and our society. You know, society at large needs to help us make those choices and give us a better menu of choices to make, so that when we need to get to work, right, that we don't just have one way to do it, which is to drive our car, right, and we have to buy a car that meets our economic needs and that turns out to be a less fuel efficient car. Instead, we need, you know, government and businesses helping us have, you know, lots of ways to get to work, right? More fuel-efficient cars or public transportation and public transportation that gets us there on time and that meets our schedules and that's comfortable. You know, we need in the 21st century to try and use our human creativity to try and build that world that offers us the choices of not only better and cheaper, but also greener, in order to break through the human footprint and transform that human footprint into something that actually works for us and works for the rest of the planet.
Let's go next to Mary in Madison.
Good morning.
Mary, good morning.
I'm enjoying the show. Once again, I'm reminded of what an utterly frustrating and nonsensical endeavor this quickly can turn out to be. And let me say first, I certainly appreciate what you're doing, and I know you're serious. But this is what I've been faced with in my everyday life, like most people. Most people I know feel guilty if a sardine can goes into the paper trash can in their own homes. But I have worked for any number of large hotels and restaurants in which a banquet will be held for between 1,000 and 2,000 people every other night. Many of these things, depending on the nature of them, are styled as picnics in that they use styrofoam cups and plates to save paying for staff washing, and they hand out mountains of soda. And I have watched in amazement as the dumpsters are just jammed with paper and thousands of soda cans and styrofoam things. Now, styrofoam may be recyclable about at this point. Some is, I know. But when I first mentioned it to the manager in the nicest possible way, several different managers, people would just laugh and say, "Are you crazy? We don't have time for that." I also have used a dumpster which is situated between a large laundromat and another large restaurant, which daily is just jammed with these great big detergent plastic containers, along with all of the food items. So comment one was, it seems really irrelevant at this point to harass people about sardine cans in their home kitchen when freely commercial establishments are dumping tons of this stuff night after night. If this is sorted out at some point, I was hoping you could tell me. And comment two was, many of us have watched and howled as various celebrities, many of whom own multiple jets, like John Travolta, one of my favorite actors, jet all over the place, sting different ones, basically berating people about their habits. And somebody actually asked one of the publicity people last year, I was lucky enough to catch it, how somebody that owns three jets, among others, I believe it's John Travolta, that's turned his personal home into a jet port that's been featured in a number of major glossy magazines, can possibly justify yapping at people in a nice way to recycle sardine cans when he owns this monstrosity of a home airport. And all the spokesman had to say nicely was, "Well, yes, that may be, but we think his message is important enough to justify him wasting whatever fuel, telling other people not to put cans in their home trash bins." And all I can say is I have nothing against these stars. I'd love to live like that too. But I have a feeling, my man, you're trying to push mud uphill. And perhaps you can address these two things. Commercial dumpsters, we've had them out here at our place and have always been assured that nothing had to be sorted out. And they just took it away, no questions asked. And secondly, what about a moratorium on these mega-rich stars telling other people not to put pop cans in their home trash bin? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mary, for your call. I'll try and say, I don't know if I can speak specifically to those two things exactly, but you know, what your call makes me think about is that's right. You know, a lot of this has been pushed to the individual level, but there's actually a lot more that can be done when people work as groups. And groups, I mean, you know, corporations are groups of people that are banded together for a particular enterprise, and in American or a capitalist economy, that enterprise is making money. So I think, you know, the most effective way to get those groups to change their behavior, and we see this, you know, every day in the economic lives of companies, is to cost some of these things, right? So if they paid more for their garbage, that would be the incentive, right? You know, I think there are arguments that can be made that are based on values and morals and ethics. And for a group of people, and I think a sizable group of people, those are very effective and they're very meaningful, and people are willing to change their behaviors solely on that basis. But there's another big group of people that these things need to be expressed in the terms that they understand and they make decisions about. And most corporations, you know, make decisions about the bottom line, and so we need to build these kind of costs into the bottom line. So, you know, I'd say actually the problem of the way people do their banquets and how much garbage they throw away is actually probably can be best addressed by costing that cost of that dumpster, right, and making it 10 times the cost for them to throw away all that stuff. And then that'll push back through the economic chain, which, you know, works very efficiently in the way that Adam Smith described, to realize those costs and build those into the economic equation. So that's the first part. The second part, I think, John Travolta and the Jets, you know, I agree that there is this potential for hypocrisy. And I think, you know, I don't know that there's a... I think the solution to that is that, you know, there are certain people that are able to collect enough wealth in our society that they can kind of buy out of the system. And that's, you know, that's a very small percentage of people that have accumulated an enormous amount of power and prestige and influence through the amount of money they have. And many of them are very talented and are very good at what they do. You know, I think we have to ask ourselves whether that's the kind of economic world we want to live in, right? Which can create these people that have, you know, frankly, more money than they could possibly ever spend in their lifetimes. And that has consequences, too, for the planet. And the way we feel about them and what they feel about the rest of us who aren't there. You know, I was just reading something that said that, you know, the two richest people in the world have more money than the 46, you know, smallest economies of the world at the national level, the 46 countries. Two people have as much money as 46 countries. I mean, I think there's something wrong there. And that's something that I hope one way or another will get redressed.
Well, what's wrong is that you and I aren't those two people.
I think it's more than that. I would like to have a little bit more money, but it's also true that I think a lot of people in my generation have made choices not to follow that, right? You know, so I have a PhD and I studied university for a long time and could have used that training to become, you know, all kinds of things, you know, a lawyer or worked on Wall Street or whatever. But I chose to become a conservationist because I thought that was what was most important, even if it meant I had to sacrifice a little bit of my material lifestyle. And when I look at my life, although it's maybe not everything I might want, you know, there's enough food for me to eat. There's enough water for me to drink. I have a house that keeps me warm at night and that keeps my son warm at night. And he has a reasonable school to go to. And I think those are the things that are most important to me. And once those sort of basic requirements are met, then I want to use my creativity and my time to try and do the right thing for the world.
Here's another caller. Robert in Elkhorn is next. Robert, good morning.
Good morning. I only have a minute, so I'll just say my piece and hop off the air and let you answer it. I was wondering if it was even possible to do an estimate for roads and buildings. I mean, they do have kind of an expected lifespan, and the country has, what, 6 million miles of roads on it that need to be replaced, like, roughly every 40 years. The amount of materials and fuel and machinery that goes into that, not even counting the buildings, is it even possible to add that all into the equation?
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, I think that's a really important point. You know, when you look at the map of the human footprint, It's effectively a map of our infrastructure overlaying our population density. That's what the map shows, and that's this gradient that you see, and you can see that out in the world. And it's true, you know, we have a huge amount of roads here in this country. There was a paper a year or two ago that tried to calculate the farthest from a road you could get in the lower 48, and the farthest place you could get from a road in the lower 48 states was 22 miles in the central Idaho wilderness. I mean, that's remarkable, right? You know, these 48 states of ours, you know, not counting Alaska or Hawaii, but they cover, you know, they span a continent. They span all of North America. And the fact that there are all those roads, all those places, you know, is good in terms of access, but A, has, what you're pointing out, huge costs in terms of having to maintain them and to develop them. And B, it has huge costs in terms of the effect on the environment, right? You know, roads and cars are a pretty destructive influence on the landscape. They divide whereas they're connecting the landscape for people, they're dividing the landscape for a lot of animals that need to move them. Something like 1 million vertebrate animals are killed on American roads every day, you know, through roadkill. And there's also effects that, you know, we could talk about more about how they affect the soil and the water and so forth, but... I would like to live in a country where we would build roads when we need them, and we would take out roads where we don't need them. And I kind of feel like maybe we have a few too many roads here in America.
I think, let's see here. We'll take another phone call and then we'll take a break. Let's go to Frank in Madison next.
Hello. This sounds like an extremely valuable exercise. And one of the things that I've observed, and it's also personal, is that it's very difficult to understand how large an effect as individuals and as a civilization that we have on the planet in aggregate. Over the rest of the century, industrial civilization has a footprint larger than the planet itself, which is a definition of unsustainable. But that's a pretty abstract statement. It may seem very stark, but it's still too abstract. And one of the things that brought it home to me that I didn't fully understand was after 9/11, I believe there was a meteorologist in Madison who took advantage of the fact that the aircraft had been grounded and made the observation that the absence of aircraft made a 1 centigrade degree difference in global temperature. So just the aircraft that we use conventionally in this civilization are responsible for 1 centigrade degree difference in the climate. So that really brought it home to me. And so thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Frank, for your comment. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that statistic about the airplanes and the temperature. What I would say, you know, that statistic that you quoted is from E.O. Wilson. E.O. Wilson calculated a few years ago that if everyone in the world consumed at the same rate as Americans, then it would take 4 worlds to provide all the resources that are available. And I agree that it's hard to imagine that, and it's hard to get a grasp on that. And part of that's because it's brand new, right? The world has never seen 6.6 billion people, and the world has never seen consumption rates on a per capita basis like we have today here in America. And the world has never seen the kind of technological prowess that we have that, you know, can put, you know, so many airplanes up in the skies, you know, on any given day. And so you put those three, you know, historically new factors together and you, you know, as Paul Ehrlich said, you multiply them, right? That's the impact is population times consumption times technology. That's the impact on the environment. And it is. It's a brand new thing. It's a wholly new phenomena. There's a great book called Something New Under the Sun, written by an environmental historian at Georgetown. And he argues, you know, from the quote in the Bible, that there's nothing new under the history of the sun. That's what the Bible says. But in fact, he says there is something brand new, and that's the environmental history of the 20th century.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got more callers who want to join the program, and you can too as lines open up. Here are the numbers, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655, toll-free. In Milwaukee, use 227-2050, 227-2050. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:46. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and here's what's coming up next hour. He's been in the state legislature, in the assembly, for 22 years, and he's calling it quits. He's Frank Boyle, perhaps the most liberal member of the Wisconsin legislature, and he's going to be on with me after 10 o'clock this morning to tell everybody in the state why he's not running for re-election, and the answer might surprise you. That's coming up after 10 this morning here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about our environmental footprint, the space we occupy on the earth and what it means that we might drink almost 40,000 cups of coffee or take 20-some thousand showers, drink so many cans of soda and so forth, how many diapers we end up using. From cradle to grave, we are consumers and we're also excretors. So this has an impact on our earth, and that's what we're talking about today. And my guest, who is helping us sort through these issues, is Eric Sanderson, Associate Director of the Living Landscapes Program at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Let's go back to the phones and take a call next from Kerry in South Milwaukee. Kerry, good morning.
Good morning. I was in Egypt a year ago, and I was in a taxi cab when the driver stopped to fill up his, his gas tank. And he was filling up the gas tank from an unusual-looking pump. When I asked him, what were you filling the car with, he said, it's gas. And he said that the car was converted to use gas, like natural gas. And then he said, I could drive all day on like 10, 5 or 10 pounds, which equals like about 2 or 3 American dollars. So I asked myself, how come, if it's so economical, how come we are not doing that?
That's a good question, Carrie. So it sounds like that was compressed natural gas. And I think actually, I don't think we're doing it for consumer cars, but I know, for example, a lot of the buses here in New York City are converted to natural gas because it is a more efficient fuel, and it also burns much more cleanly, so it doesn't put as much of the kind of polluting particulate matter and some of the chemicals that make smog in the city. It still makes CO2, and it's still a fossil fuel, so it's better in some ways, but it still isn't what we really need, which is a way to get off of fossil fuels. You know, in the film, they talk, they have a couple scenes about cars, and the statistics about cars in America are pretty amazing. You know, something like 5% of the global population lives in America, but we drive 30% of the world's automobiles. And something that I didn't quite really appreciate is that the average American, in over the course of their lifetime, will go through 12 different vehicles. And so it's not only, you know, it's the sum total of the miles that we drive, which is huge, which leads us to using 10.5 million barrels of oil per day, which is quite a bit, but leading to us putting more than half of the world's carbon dioxide emissions in the atmosphere every year just from one country. But also all the parts that are taken, that are needed to make those cars, right? The steel, the plastic, the glass, all the different pieces that go into those cars. So I think we're paying a very high environmental cost for our car culture. And I totally realize when people say to me all the time, well, you know, that's a very difficult problem, and we actually really depend on our cars, and moreover, we like our cars. And, I too, you know, appreciate the freedom of driving in a car. But I think we need to kind of figure out a way to do our cars better. We need to kind of bring that American can-do attitude and creativity and freedom of thought and ideas to our car culture and try and figure out a way to get out of it.
We, according to the film, each American, or the average American, will create 22 tons of carbon dioxide emissions each year. And, of course, that's way more than the average for the rest of the world. But what all does this 22-ton figure include? It can't just be automobile exhaust.
No, it's also our heating costs. That's right. You know, most of and our electricity costs, most electricity in the United States is generated from fossil fuels that put CO2 in the air. Most of our houses are if they're not heated by electricity, they're heated by oil or natural gas. I'm not sure what's most common up in Wisconsin. Anytime you burn fossil fuels, they put carbon dioxide in the air. It's worth repeating. I don't know that it gets said enough that, you know, those, it took, you know, millions and millions and millions of years for the trees to grow and then fall down and then get built into the rock, into the geology to create our reserves of oil and our reserves of coal and our natural gas. And it'll take millions and millions and millions of years to bring those back. Those things are not renewable over a short time scale. And they're really valuable things. You know, all our plastics are made from oil. A lot of the antecedents of chemicals that feed the pharmaceutical industry and the chemical industry, the herbicide and agricultural chemical industry, all those, you know, a lot of those things start from the oil chain. So oil is actually a really valuable commodity and something that we should use carefully.
We'll go next to Jenny in Sturgeon Bay. Jenny, good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've heard that one of the most environmentally responsible things you can do individually is to follow a vegan diet, basically consuming no animal products, either as food or as consumer goods. And I'm a vegan myself, and I'm actually just wondering today, is the diet, the lifestyle of a vegan really as green and environmentally friendly as I've heard it is? And I will take my answer off the air. Thank you.
That's a great question, and I think it's more complicated. I mean, it is true what you're saying, that it is more efficient, but it may not be as green as you're hoping it has been. And I applaud you for making that sacrifice. So, I understand that most people are not gonna want to do that too. But it's an ecological fact that all the energy that drives the world comes from the sun. The sun is the ultimate source, and in ecosystems, that sun is captured by plants, and then that energy is eaten by animals, and then sometimes other animals eat those animals, like people eating cows that eat the grass that grows into the sun. Every time it changes from one of those levels, from the sun to the grass, and from the grass to the animal, and from the animal to us, it only passes on about 10% of the energy. So it's a very inefficient system. So just by the fact of you moving down one level and eating only vegetables and not eating animal products means that that you're leaving, if you like, 90% of that energy out in the ecosystems, and that's a great help. But in terms of, you have to also ask yourself where the vegetables that you're eating are coming from, because it turns out that many of the green foods, like if you go to Whole Earth Market, they're actually coming from all over the world, and I've Whole Foods, they're starting to label where their fruits and vegetables come from, and I think that's really important because that's an important part of the consumer decision. So the best thing, of course, would be to eat plants and also animals for those people that feel like they have to eat animals, but ones that come from local sources, from close places. And Wisconsin is blessed with great and very productive farmland and cheeses and dairies and that sort of thing. So you're very fortunate that way. But to the extent that we can eat food and use resources that are close to us, it reduces the transportation costs, which is great. And it also means it shortens the economic chain so that, if you buy your food from a green market, you're actually talking to the farmer, right? And if there's something that farmer's doing that you don't like about the way they raise their food, you can tell them, and they can tell you, well, I'm doing it because of this. That's why I'm doing it. So it actually enables that conversation, and that's also a very positive thing. And finally, if you're using up too much of the land around you to support your lifestyle, you'll see that. You'll see it manifested in the landscape that's around you and that you love. And I think all those things are really strong arguments for, to the extent possible, to eat and use things that come from our local environment.
Thanks for that call. Let's go next to Kathy in Waupaca. Kathy, good morning.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I hope someone in authority at the state level is listening to this, because I have a little beef with the mandatory recycling law in Wisconsin. I think it's a fine idea so far as it goes, and we recycle all the stuff that we can, but the onus is entirely on the consumer. So the manufacturer or producer can use as much excessive packaging as they want, and we're the ones who have to recycle it, make room for it in the house, et cetera, et cetera. And you get these products that have the little recycling label on them, plastic things, but then it doesn't have a number on it. And if it's not a 1 or a 2, we can't recycle it here. So what happens with it? You don't know what it is, so it goes in the trash. That's my problem with it. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, those are great points. I'm not a recycling expert, but that's right. This is not only an individual responsibility. It's also a corporate responsibility and a government responsibility. And I meant to look up the statistics before the show, but the amount of consumer packaging that goes into the things that we buy has gone up tremendously over the last 30 years. For those of you who are old enough, you think back to the 70s and when you would buy things, there wasn't nearly the kind of packaging that we have today, and it's a lot, and like you say, it all goes into trash. I heard someone at the National Geographic Society say recently that, that one of the, when we go to buy a product, there's several things that we consider, right? We consider the price, and we consider the quality, of course, and we consider the convenience. And one of the ways that businesses have tried to sell us more over the last period is by enhancing the convenience. And that convenience argument, throwaway things, singly wrapped meals, et cetera, has really increased the amount of stuff that we have to, reuse. Reduce, reuse, and recycle. I mean, it just makes it much, much harder. So on the one hand, I applaud you for your recycling, and I'm glad that Wisconsin has a recycling law. It sounds like maybe it could use some spiffing up a little bit. But I think we also have to realize that these are just not on us, each of us as individuals, but they're also on businesses and governments to help us make better choices and give us those better choices to make.
Well, making better choices seems like a good place to leave this, because we're out of time and we still have full phone banks. Clearly, this is a topic that we need to revisit. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Eric.
Yeah, you're welcome. And I'd just like to say I really appreciate all the thoughtful questions from your listeners.
Well, on their behalf, you're very welcome.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Eric Sanderson is Associate Director of the Living Landscapes Program at the Wildlife Conservation Society. The television program, if you want to watch it, is going to be on the National Geographic Channel on Sunday night at 8 o'clock Central Time. And you can check your local listings to find out where that channel is on your cable or satellite system. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. John Treader handled the on-air production. If you'd like a copy of it, call the radio store at 800-747-7444 and ask for program 410-D. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.